Hello and welcome to Somebody's Watching. I'm Ellie Levy. This episode I spoke with Professor Nikolai Lubecker, who is a French and film studies professor at Oxford and wrote the book The Feel Bad Film, which came out in 2015. I came across his book a couple of years ago and I immediately got very excited. Finally, there was a book about the type of film that I've always felt drawn to, and thankfully, the book did not disappoint. Just the opposite, in fact. I'd recommend the book to anyone who wants to explore why these movies work for us, despite going against what we're led to believe is the ideal film experience. In this conversation, we talk about the different types of feel-bad films, catharsis, the ethical value of these films, and a lot more. We refer to quite a few movies in our conversation. I added a list of them, as well as a link to Professor Lubecker's book in the show notes. All right, here's the episode. Hello, and welcome to Somebody's Watching. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest today is Professor Nikolai Lubecker, a professor of French and film studies at St. John's College, the University of Oxford. I felt very spoken to when I first came across your book, The Feel Bad Film, about difficult, uncomfortable films and why they are important. And it was a wonderful and very clarifying read. So I'd love to explore some of that with you and discuss your book, basically, in our chat today. So first of all, what is your definition of a feel-bad film?
Well, I define it by saying these are films that stimulate in the reader a desire for catharsis, and then they don't deliver on that desire. So I think I have a condensed formulation about how they invite and deadlock a desire for catharsis. So that makes for a very visceral viewing experience. That makes these films unpleasant to watch. That makes them stomach churners and films that you feel in your gut. And they are so very deliberately, a lot of them at least. So that's my definition.
And you also, in this context, you reference Sartre and Antonin Artaud and Georges Bataille. Do you want to maybe get into a little bit more of the theory of that, of how it relates?
Yeah, I can do that. I can perhaps start with Sartre. And what I'm using Sartre to speak about is how we usually conceive of the relationship or the contract between, I'm actually drawing on a text on, which is about literature, it doesn't matter too much, but it's about how the contract between reader and writer is one in which the writer stimulates the freedom or offers something to the freedom of the reader, and the reader in return kind of almost composes and creates the work with the writer. And it's a very ecstatic paragraph in a text called What is Literature? Where Sartre is kind of theorizing the reception of art as a very kind of collaborative project between artist and receiver. And then I kind of use that in order to say that there are other forms of addressing, and there are certain kind of contracts that are much more problematic and much more antagonistic and unpleasant. Then at the end of the book, I come back to Sartre and say that that reading that I delivered in my introduction is one that perhaps simplifies, and there's actually in Sartre an understanding of this being a much more complicated setup. But basically, we often tend to want to think about the relationship between artists and the ones that are looking at art or reading a text as one that is harmonious, and perhaps even we can pin certain kind of hopes about democracy on that contract. So that in Sartre, there's a certain way of reading Sartre where it feels like he's proposing that contract between reader and writer as an example of how to coexist as human beings. And there are other critics that have been very keen to pick up on that idea, and I speak about some of those too. So that's a very kind of idealistic and romantic a little bit idea about how art might actually pave the way for something like peaceful interaction between human beings. And it's difficult to work with that conception of art if you're looking at certain feel-bad films, if you're looking at Funny Games, or if you're looking at Lars von Trier's Dogville, and it doesn't feel like that's really what's going on. So that's what I do with Sartre. I can continue and say something about how Bataille and Artaud belong to kind of 1920s and 30s avant-garde literature, very transgressive art, and they propose a form of interaction that is much more wild and unruly and perhaps also unpleasant at times. So I use them to open up some of these feel bad films. So they come into the readings. But at the beginning of the book, I wanted to polemicize a little bit against a certain form of very optimistic understanding of what art is about. And also, it's not only optimistic, but I think it's also kind of a limiting way of conceiving art. And I get worried when art is supposed to be playing only that role.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thank you for getting a little deeper into your theory there. So in your book, you divide feel-bad films into three main categories. You have other categories, but these are the main ones. The assaultive films, the unease films, and the transgressive films. Could you explain those categories briefly?
Yeah, so the first, well, kind of the distinction here is between, you might say, the kind of the directness of the feel-bad experience. So the assaultive films are films that are very kind of unequivocally aggressing and playing with the viewer. So they might come across as almost cynical or sadistic. They initiate that very clear power struggle between spectator and director, or spectator and film, if you want. So those are assaultive films. And my examples there are films by Lars von Trier and Haneke, for instance. So I think most listeners, if they're familiar with the works of Haneke and Trier, they will know roughly what I'm speaking about when I talk about the assaultive films. The second category then are the films of unease, which also frustrate us. But they probably frustrate us in a slightly less aggressive manner. They confuse us. They make us uncertain about what kind of experience that it is we're having. And here I can maybe mention a few films as well. So I speak about or I analyze Gus Van Sant's Elephant. There's a section on a film by Claire Denis, an early film by Claire Denis called I Can't Sleep, J'ai pas sommeil. And there's also a little bit about Haneke's Hidden there. And what is perhaps worth saying about those three films is that they're all dealing with historical material or with real life events of a traumatic nature. So in the case, for instance, of Gus Van Sant's Elephant, it's about a high school shooting at Columbine High. And those moments and dealing with kind of a recent traumatic event that puts a lot of pressure on a director to deliver something like comfort and something like perhaps even a kind of an analysis that would help us push on and move on from the trauma. And I think that Van Sant and Denis and also Haneke, when he's doing Hidden, which is about Franco-Algerian relations, they all want to avoid that role where they go in and offer solutions or offer something productive, and they instead confuse us. So that provokes that kind of very strong sense of unease. It's not only films that deal with historical events that can provoke that feeling of unease. My last example in that section is Lucie Letty-Elie Lewitsch's film Innocence, so one of her first films, which is also a bewildering and kind of confusing film where we kind of worry about what's happening and whether we are on kind of in yeah, ethically murky waters in some ways.
Right. Yeah, I want to talk about that film later on. Yeah.
Yeah. So the last kind of category, the last section of the book, because this is a little bit the division of the book as well, is about it's called transgression, and it's a slightly different section from the previous sections, because it's also a section that wants to think about how these films, that most of them are films that were made at the beginning of this century, why there were so many of these films and how they might differ from earlier forms of transgressive films. So I'm thinking here about the relationship between surrealist or historical avant-garde art, and perhaps some of the films of the 60s, Pasolini, Godard, etc., who also made very transgressive films, and then the films that came after year 2000, basically. And what I'm theorizing there, or what I'm arguing, is that the films perhaps differ from those earlier forms of transgressive art by not believing they can offer some form of emancipation, where perhaps a lot of the earlier avant-garde art was tied up with political, or at least some of it was tied up with political communist leanings, for instance, or whatever it might be, the dream of a classless society. Then these films, part of their frustration and has to do with the fact that we can't really find that political vision, and they've been criticized for not delivering that political vision. And I then speak about why I think that even if they don't deliver that political vision, at least some of them, then I think it's valuable nevertheless to make films like that, if nothing else, to communicate very clearly that we don't have that political vision, and maybe we should all try to do something about that.
Yeah, we don't have the answers.
Yeah,
you already mentioned this term, deadlock. So my question would be, this deadlock on catharsis in these films, why do they usually avoid catharsis? And what does this do with us, the viewers?
Yeah, so I think there are different ways of answering that question. And that's what I'm kind of trying to go through a little bit in the film. And the films don't, it's not as if a kind of a feel-bad film and a deadlock on catharsis always means the same thing. So, for instance, some of the films I just kind of briefly talked about and that relate to historical events, let's say Gus Van Sant's Elephant, I think kind of by confusing us, by not delivering those answers and by not offering kind of a coherent explanation as to why some young people might go into a school and kill their school friends, etc. He's in the film, he's kind of teasing us a little bit and offering up all kinds of possible suggestions as to why the tragedy happened. And these are suggestions that were made at the time of the film. Is it because they were homosexuals? Is it because they were whatever? And he's victims of bullying. Is it because they played too many video games, etc.? And he's kind of flirting with all these different explanations, which obviously aren't really explanations, and teasing us a little bit with that. And in the end, not allowing us to believe in any of those simplistic ideas. So I think what he then ultimately does is to kind of say to us that maybe sometimes we should be very careful about wanting to come up with answers. Maybe we should just, and that's basically what I think he's doing in the film. He's staying with these young people, and he's filming them beautifully. He's caring for them, but he's not offering any explanation, and he's not wanting us to move on from the tragedy. And kind of there is traditionally, in all kinds of, and for very good reasons, that there is a rush to judge, to find the people who, or the explanation as to why something happened, and then to move on. And that kind of intervention by which you delay that movement, moment of moving on, is, I think, a very valuable reminder in dealing with some of these traumatic events. So that's one answer to why kind of a deadlock on catharsis can function in an ethical way.
In a book with a lot of highlights for me, your section on Elephant was really quite astounding. Like, it really made me reevaluate the film and its treasures. So speaking of, again, we're sticking with the catharsis topic. It's going a little bit beyond your book, but I'm just wondering how you define it. So you mentioned that Catherine Breillat's A Fat Girl and Lars von Trier's The Idiots are cathartic. So I was wondering, like, what in your mind makes them cathartic, even though, you know, a lot of us who've seen these films still feel quite demoralized and depressed after watching it. And more broadly speaking, like, what are the signs of catharsis?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I should probably say that the notion of catharsis is an extremely complicated one. And to begin with, when I started writing the book, I read my way into Aristotle, and I read my way into the Aristotle reception, etc., because he uses the term in a couple of famous but very brief passages in a few of his texts. And what you have there is quite different from how we maybe use it. Well, it's not even easy to say that it's different from how we usually use the term, because it's very difficult to say exactly, or there's a lot of debate about what it is Aristotle is saying in those passages. So I'm working with a slightly kind of reductive idea about, or maybe a slightly everyday-like understanding of what catharsis might be. And I'm drawing also on Bertolt Brecht and his criticism of Aristotelian theater. And I'm also drawing on some of the ways in which we might theorize what catharsis means in speaking about Hollywood films. So basically, I'm thinking catharsis as kind of an experience that allows us to liberate ourselves from something that is traumatic or problematic or haunts us, etc. And therefore it comes with a certain form of kind of satisfaction. It's nice to be watching a cathartic film. We get past a certain things or certain things by doing that. So that's the initial kind of definition of the cathartic. I think then when we talk about Lars von Trier and The Idiots and Catherine Breillat, those two films for me are in line with a lot of the traditional avant-garde art, in the sense that in traditional avant-garde art, let's say surrealism, there was a belief, at least in many forms of surrealism, and also later in the 60s, there was a belief that kind of by transgressing, you might reveal something new and positive, and you might explode your way to something new. That basically the transgressive experience was also a liberating experience. And I think in The Idiots, that is what we are meant to understand at the very end, when Karen is transgressing in her family setting. In a sense, she shows how hollow all the other idiots have been in their flirtation with the transgressive. And she offers something that is a real kind of a transgression. And it takes place in a family setting where they've just lost a small child. So it's harrowing, but it is liberating for her. So that's why I see that film. And I mean, liberating, and we don't. There's a bit of tongue in cheek, as always, with Lars von Trier. So he offers that as a kind of a transgressive and emancipatory experience, knowing very well that people might not all buy into it. And I think something similar can be said about Catherine Breyer's Fat Girl, where I'm giving away all the endings, but it's important to do so. But where kind of the final moment where the younger sister, in a sense, claims and owns her rape story and says that it isn't a rape, that in fact this is yes, this is almost, she's almost kind of saying this is what I wanted, and that's in a sense problematic in all kinds of ways. But I think what Catherine Breyer means to suggest is that this is a young woman who's now been liberated from a certain gender stereotype that her sister, for instance, has to live with. So I think kind of it's an extremely provocative film, but I think that we're meant to think that that it's a liberating experience, this incident in the forest at the very very end.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it's quite a claim, but I think that's the claim of Catherine Breyer.
Yeah, definitely. These are very like specifically to these films. This could maybe be seen as cathartic, but anywhere else, it would be like probably not. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's true. But it is. That's the provocation. And even kind of maybe, one of the arguments in the book is also that we should be allowed to do things in the cinema that we wouldn't want to have outside of the cinema. And I think that's what both Catherine Breyer and Lars von Trier are taking advantage of here. They're exploring that idea of a rape being liberating and of a kind of a provocation in the setting of an infant death being meaningful as well. Yeah. So very, very kind of heightened and provocative endings.
Yes. This leads wonderfully to the next question, which is that you make it very clear that there's a difference between what we experience within the confines of the cinema and outside of it. And I think that's something that many people are quite hung up about historically and also now. Yeah. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference and the importance of what you call thinking evil.
Yeah. So I think you're right in phrasing the question like that. And I think for me, I think it's very important to allow things to be tested and experimented with in an artistic setting or within the cinema room that you wouldn't want to have outside of the cinema room. That kind of goes to the core of the whole argument in the book and why it is these feel bad films can be doing ethical work. And I think what they do is, among other things, to reveal the human psyche in all of its complexity, that it's possible for us to imagine a situation where rape is liberating. Or there's an invitation there to try to imagine a situation where rape is liberating. And I think, that's problematic in all kinds of ways. But that kind of problem is a problem that is part of our human psyche. We have that capacity to imagine something like that, and engaging with those kinds of extreme ideas and extreme drives and is something that is that can be valuable. I think it also is valuable in the sense that, so one of the kind of, I have a number of different kind of theoretical texts I'm drawing on also while making this argument about kind of the specificity of the experiences that we can have in art. One of them is a short text by Julia Kristeva, who is arguing that in art, all kinds of transgression can allow us to understand the violence if we familiarize ourselves with these. You can think of that kind of the artistic experience almost as a laboratory for examining the kind of the darker regions of the human soul, but not just the human soul, also the darker regions of reality. And if we deprive ourselves of the possibility of doing things like that, then we will end up being incapable of thinking the evil that happens outside of the cinema room. And her text is specifically about 9/11 and the attack on Twin Towers and all the responses that event generated. All those people, the text is called How Can One Be a Terrorist? And she's kind of, this is not Christy Vass' question. This is the question that everyone was asking themselves after 9/11, and Christopher is saying, well, where have you been if you are actually surprised that people can be terrorists at time? And then there's an invitation to think about using art. And she's not just speaking about, well, she's speaking about film, but she's also speaking about religious texts and how they've been able to deal with the violent events.
Okay, here's a kind of a big question. What is the ethical and political value of the Feel Bad film?
Yeah, so I think I've talked a little bit about some of the things you can do. You can postpone judgment. I think that's ethically valuable. Can be politically valuable also. Which I think is what Gus Van Sant does with the elephant. I can maybe speak a little bit about Lars von Trier again. I speak about Dogville. That's the first analysis in the book. And what I think he's doing with that film is there's a play with the spectator, and the listeners who've seen the film, they will know that it's a very peculiar film in terms of its set. So it's been filmed in a big industrial setting in Sweden where they used to construct trains, I think it was. And so it's a huge, almost factory hall where everything is painted black. And then on the floor, he has drawn up with a white paint a city, and he has introduced a bed in a room or a door or certain props. And so we have kind of a sketched version of a city. And that is something it's extremely alienating to look at first. And then we start building the town in our own minds. And it becomes in times extremely absorbing because we are producing the image track or immersing ourselves in it in a particular way because of that very peculiar setting. And he does then kind of play with this push and pull between immersing ourselves, letting us immerse ourselves and holding us at a distance. And then towards the very end of the film, it's a horrible story of humiliations after humiliations on Grace, played by Nicole Kidman. And towards the end of the film, she takes revenge and she kills off basically the whole town. And that moment is extremely cathartic. Then it's extremely satisfactory, and we feel kind of finally she responded, and finally she did something about it. And at that point, there's a certain kind of line of chalk line outline of a dog that then begins to materialize and becomes a dog that is barking straight into the camera. The camera descends to the barking dog. And I read that as a kind of almost a signature by Lars von Trier. He's shown us that that kind of violence and barking dog and aggression, something that I translate that dog straight into a certain concept from Danish culture, which is called the inner bastard, the inner swine dog. And it was a concept that was used a lot in the 90s in Denmark to speak about how the right-wing party was appealing to our inner bastard, stimulating our desire for all kinds of antisocial things and using that to kind of implement a very inhumane policy towards foreigners. So I think that is what he has in mind, and he wants to show us that we have things like that. And then in that way, he basically kind of pulls the carpet underneath our satisfaction, or under kind of he quenches that kind of cathartic feeling. And we suddenly come to understand that, okay, we actually have it in us to want for gruesome revenge. And also, because it is a story about xenophobia, also perhaps we have some of those antisocial drives that can be exploited by a right-wing party. So here, I think that the Feel Bad film and the Feel Bad experience allows us almost to live that kind of, how can I say, the antisocial, to live it instead of just watching it. We very often have films where we are allowed to watch characters that are, act in antisocial ways, and we are in those situations kind of still able to say that, well, yeah, it doesn't concern us. We might not do like that. But what Trier's manipulations allow him to do is to bring it out in us. And I think that's an extremely ethical point to make. So we need to be aware of the fact that we might have an inner bastard somewhere, and that might then kind of lead to all kinds of political and ethical discussions. So this is obviously also a political film, and let's be careful with that inner bastard. Some of these films, at least, they may come across as initially being anti-humanist, but what they allow us to realize is this kind of, for instance, yeah, these dark drives, whatever you want to call them, this inner bastard. And by bringing that into the light, they can be fitted into a kind of a larger and less naive understanding about what a contemporary form of humanism might be.
And are there any feel-bad films that you deem to be kind of ethically dangerous? Your discussion of Brian De Palma's Redacted about the Iraq War implies that you might, but...
Yeah. So my argument in that section is that it's a problematic film because it kind of mixes reality and fiction in a way where it doesn't allow the viewer to distinguish between the two. So that can be, I think, yeah, if I'm saying, and I'm arguing that we should be able to do things in art that we shouldn't do outside, then obviously as soon as you begin to play with the relationship between the fictional and the real, then you're open towards something that can become problematic. Whether I'm now kind of, yeah, it's another of those sections where I'm thinking, I wonder if De Palma's anger and political frustration with the Bush regime at the time, I wonder if I was a little bit too harsh on De Palma in my evaluation of Redacted. The more general answer to your question is that, yeah, I think you can go too far, and you can in particular go too far, or you can muddle things if you play with the border between fiction and reality in such a way that you make it difficult for viewers to see what is what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you have maybe another film example that comes to mind, when, not to put you on the spot, but
yeah, that's fine. I'm not sure I do, but kind of tipping over into so actually at the moment I'm working on documentary film, and there are lots of documentary films that are very unpleasant as well to watch. There are certain documentary films that manipulate in ways where I become worried about them, and they do the feel bad experience, but I haven't analyzed them in feel bad terms, so I think I'll rather not offer a title for you. So.
But now that you mentioned documentaries, I do wonder what you think of the film The Act of Killing.
Yeah.
How do you find that film in this context, or just in general, morally, maybe?
Yeah. I think it's a very complicated film morally. I haven't written about it, and I'm not writing about it in the new project, but I have been thinking about it. And one of the things, there are many things that need discussion. And one of the things that I was struck by when I went to a screening of it, where Joshua Oppenheimer was there, and he was presenting the film, and he was doing a Q&A afterwards, and it was extremely interesting. And I think it's also, so here there is an element of framing that is very useful. I think it's fantastic that he has been so active in going around and engaging with viewers, not just here, but but all over the world, including where these events took place, not least where these events took place. So there's a fantastic work being done there. One of the things I was going to say, which I was kind of skeptical about, was the fact that I remember when he talked about it, he said that the main character was one that he chose after having seen 40 different people who had all been involved in the genocide and who had been playing key roles. And he felt that with this particular character, that would be, or this particular man, that would be a chance that he might kind of break down as he does at the very end. And I feel like that's a bit,
yeah.
So that is, so it does deliver a redemptive, or kind of it, in the end, it does deliver a redemptive ending. Not in the sense that all problems are solved, but at least in the sense that this monster turns out to be more like us and more humane than we thought he initially was, and that he has kind of suggested that he was all throughout the film. Mm. And that's a little bit, that's comforting. But I have to say, then I think that if it's only one in 40, that's also almost a bit too comforting. But there are so many things to say about the act of killing.
Yeah.
And again, you can hear I'm not too keen to
sure.
condemn it.
Yeah. No, I'm not condemning it either. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
As you said, very complicated.
Yeah.
Since I have you here, I also wanted to ask you what you thought of, or what you think of George Sluiser's The Vanishing, if you've seen it.
I have seen it. It's a long time ago, so I don't think I can answer that very well.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think it has one of the best endings of a film ever, but I kind of was wondering if it kind of would count, like, because it's such a satisfying, unsatisfying kind of ending.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you can try reminding me, and I'll see if I.
So in the film, the boyfriend who's looking for his missing, yeah. I think it's girlfriend, is just so desperate to find out what happened that he, finds the killer and basically makes the killer reveal what happened to his girlfriend. And the only way the killer can do that is by doing the same thing to him. To the boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically buries him alive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah. 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 I'm wondering if it's a neat ending in a sense, doesn't it? Kind of, it ties everything neatly together, doesn't it? In The Vanishing.
Yeah. In a really awful way, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But maybe it's not confusing. Maybe there is a form of, maybe after all, there is a form of mathematical precision to how things panned out that gives you a certain amount of aesthetic pleasure. I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of the act of killing or that other parts of the world, do you have examples of non-Western feel-bad films?
Yeah, I think there are feel-bad films from all over the world. And I have a footnote, I think, in the book where I say that I'm basically working on films in the book that where I could understand the language. That's not entirely true. There is a Dutch film in there, and I don't speak Dutch, but the other films are all made in languages where I understand the language, and it allows me to read a lot more around the films. So that was a bit the limitation that I kind of set up for myself, that I would only do that.
Right.
But I think I also say in that footnote, I feel like that there would be a lot to look at in terms of Asian cinema, and there would be a lot to look at in other contexts. And I think I say in the footnote that I would hope that someone else would go and do that. And as it happens, it has actually, the notion has been picked up here and there, and the definition I kind of give of it has also been used to analyze Mexican films and to analyze other forms of films. And one of the nice kind of things that happened after the publication of the book was that I was invited to Pittsburgh to a symposium on Russian film by some graduate students who had read the book and who felt that it spoke well to Russian film. So I was kind of invited to speak about various films in that context. For instance, an artist and also installation or performance artist, Oleg Mavromati, who's made a film called Monkey Ostrich Grave, which I was kind of asked to introduce and think about in terms of feel bad film. And it was an extremely feel bad film. So there are lots of the Russian feel bad film that you can think of. But it's these readings, they take quite a lot of time to make. But I have the sense that, I don't know, I haven't, for instance, seen Harmonium. Have you seen that film by Fukada? Kochi Furukawa is a Japanese film. I think that might work well, but there are obviously also other films. I think very often, or some people who have been referring to the book have been kind of importing the notion a little bit and using it for horror films more specifically. Yeah. And I think very often in horror that there is satisfaction, or it feels a little bit like, at least certain forms of horror, it feels like as a thrill and a roller coaster ride involved sometimes, not always, but in some of them. But I think maybe something like Audition by Miike might work for feel bad as well, because one of the things that film does is to kind of play melodrama against horror in a way where we end up being manipulated and being very confused about it. But I haven't seen Audition for a very long time either. So,
yeah, because also you mentioned, right, that feel bad films, it's not really one specific genre, or it's also usually not the body genre, like horror and
no,
like that, because it's really more in the murky kind of in-betweenness.
Exactly. But I think that you can find them all over the world, and I think that kind of there is a, in a sense, I think that's an argument. And if I had been able to, or if I wanted to do a volume 2 or 3 or something like that, it would strengthen the argument about the necessity of having a form of film that allows us to express the messiness of human nature and all its complexity, and that tendency is something that you can find across cultures.
So I also like to talk about women directors making feel bad films, like Marina Devan, who made In My Skin, which I would also categorize in a way a horror film. We also showed it at the festival I co-direct. And Lucille Hadzi-Halilovic, who directed Innocence. Can you talk a bit about the portrayal of women and girls in these films and how it aligns with feel badness?
Yeah. So I think the one where the kind of the issue of gender is most relevant and important. It's important in both of them. It's very important in both of them. But the easiest one to speak about, let's say, is Marina Devan, maybe In My Skin, which is, it's crucial here that we're speaking about a female body. I think this is a film that delivers a critique of a certain kind of corporate capitalist, highly patriarchal world that is very recognizable. And the outcast in that kind of society, the one that kind of suffers most in a kind of a capitalist, corporate, patriarchal society is the young woman. And her response here is to engage in acts of self-mutilation. Mm-hmm. And she does that in a way where I think it becomes... Yeah, it's a harrowing watch, and it becomes a very courageous and bold a film in a form of revolt. I put it in the category of desperation films because it's kind of showing something horrible without offering any kind of way out. And I use a quote from Frederick Jameson where he speaks about when there's nothing other left to do, then maybe kind of the act of rattling the bars, as you would do in a prison, is in itself the best we can do. And I feel like this is what she's doing here. And I think that gender comes into it in the sense that it is also a man's world that she's rattling, where she's caged and rattling the bars. And the fact that it is a film that is, she's in every shot, and she's the one who directed the film and wrote the film, etc. That kind of heightens that sense of desperation and the courageousness of the whole enterprise even more. So I think it's a very bold film, and it would not have been possible to make that, or it would have been an extremely different experience had it been a male character. I can't see it work with a male character. So,
yeah.
Whereas the kind of Atsia Lilovic's film is interesting. When I wrote about it, she hadn't yet made the film that she was about to make later, Evolution.
Right.
So in Innocence, she is examining pre-pubertarian girls in a boarding school, ballet school in the middle of a forest. And it's a fantastic and very eerie and very difficult film. I think it was probably the film I had most difficulties writing about, because it's so difficult to know what it's doing. Nevertheless, it's an extremely seductive and interesting film. And then she redid that kind of trick a little bit by making a film with young boys who are slightly older on an isolated island, who are undergoing experiments by something that is somewhere between a kind of their mothers, but we kind of assume they're not really their mothers, but they're also a little bit fish-like, and these creatures, and they are possibly even kind of the victims of experimentations that happened before the film started. So she has done kind of investigations into sexuality, I would say, and the complexity of sexuality in ways where we are not always feeling entirely comfortable. And some of the responses to Innocence, in particular, probably in the Anglo-American reception, were very worried about whether there was a degree of exploitation happening and whether there was a kind of a flirtation with something that could be thought of as a form of almost, an exploitation of those young girls sexually, which I think is wrong. But I understand why the worry was there. Those two films by Atsia Lilovic, in a sense, shows also, I think, that some of the I don't see them as Innocence is about female young girls' bodies, and it's based on a short story by Wedekind, a German language, I think he was Austrian, but I'm not entirely sure, author from the kind of the turn of the, or he was contemporary with Freud, so we're around 1900, and his book is called On the Bodily Education. It's called Mine Haha, or On the Bodily Education of Young Girls. And that is the topic. But then she also adds to that, Atsia Lilovic, something like The Bodily Education of Young Boys in the film that comes after. Both of them are extremely beautiful and also extremely difficult to pin down.
Yeah. Have you also seen her most latest one, The Earwig?
I've also seen The Earwig, which is also a very beautiful film. I thought that here the plot structure was almost so, it was so elliptical that perhaps it didn't make a stronger an impression on me as the other two films. She also made a fantastic short film. I don't know if you saw that, with the women as bees almost. I can't remember what it's called now off the top of my head. But it's amazing, and I think that is about the way I look at it, it might not be the way to look at it, is to also see it as a film about menopause. So she's engaging with female sexuality, but at a later stage in life.
Mm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And now, like on a more general note, I guess what is it like working on subject matter that potentially alienates and or frustrates people? By many people.
I mean, I enjoyed writing the book.
Yeah,
it was some And I taught the films as well in different settings. I was mostly at the University of Aberdeen, where I was before I came to Oxford. I had kind of these sessions where I would sit and watch the films with the students, and the students would be more and more, what is it you're doing to us, and why are you doing it to us? But nevertheless, they were up for it and responding in all kinds of interesting ways. And I have to say, I wonder now whether I would dare to teach all of the films again. I think things have changed a little bit, and some of these films, I was perhaps a little bit naive and thought I could do anything without creating too much fuss. But I thought it was really fun to write. I have had those kind of reactions where I've been almost asked to justify myself for working on something like that. And I think it's very easy to justify it. And I hope I've been able to show that to some extent. But it made me wonder, because I work on literature and I work on film, and it's made me wonder sometimes also about the difference between those two media, and how we probably are willing to allow for horrors in literature that, or we are no doubt willing to engage with field-bound literature to a much larger extent, and it's much more socially accepted than engaging with it in a film medium. So these films are not necessarily darker than what you can find in Dostoevsky or Zola or others. So the various things I've worked on, it's probably the book that I have kind of delivered most satisfaction in terms of how people have been eager to speak about it. That's been extremely rewarding.
Yeah, it definitely spoke to me. As I said, like I've kind of been waiting for this kind of book, I think, for a while. Yeah. So yeah, it's great.
That's great.
Have you always been kind of drawn to these kind of films? You talk mostly about contemporary or almost contemporary films, but I'm just wondering a bit of your history with this kind of genre or subgenre.
Yeah, I think I've been drawn to them, but I've worked on surrealism, for instance. I've worked on Bataille and others. So I've been interested in transgressive art in different at different times in history and in different media. I've kind of anecdotally as well. When I finished the Feelbad film, I thought I would do something very different and much more kind of peaceful. So I started working on slow cinema, and I'm very interested in slow cinema as well. But kind of when I started looking at what kind of slow films I was working at, it became clear to me that the project was drifting towards all kinds of unpleasant slow cinema. So it kind of came in, and now I'm working on. When I'm working on documentary films, a lot of those documentary films are also about things that are painful and traumatizing. So, yeah, I think I have perhaps an attraction to that.
Mm-hmm. I can relate for sure.
Yeah.
So, on the other hand, what are your thoughts on feel-good movies, and can they serve an emancipatory and thoughtful purpose as well?
Oh yeah. I can watch feel good films and enjoy them, and also take things from them. And I think there are lots of films that can stimulate thinking in all kinds of interesting ways. There are, of course, a lot of brilliant comedies. There are a lot of brilliant musicals, and very often they will, some of them at least, will be overall feel good. So. I appreciate that, and I think that all kinds of films can be thought provoking. I don't actually, maybe I should say that as well. I don't consider the term feel bad as a positive term. I think of it as these films that deadlock catharsis, and they can be good and they can be bad. The same way I think feel good movies can be sometimes good and interesting, and sometimes they aren't. But that's just how it is. I don't know. Obviously, some of the feel-good films, they also, in order to really feel kind of liberating, they have to go through a dark passage, and then we emerge on the other side. And I think a film like this is perhaps not a conventional feel-good film, but one of the films that I felt really good after watching was Lucas Moodysson's debut, Show Me Love. I don't know if you've seen that. Kind of a coming-of-age film, set in a very small town in Sweden, and it's very empowering and very beautiful. It's a love story between two young girls. There are all kinds of films can be interesting, I think. You said if they can also be emancipatory. One of the things about these feel bad films is that they aren't always emancipatory, I think even that experience is interesting and worthwhile, and we should pause and think about what happens when they aren't.
That hold up a higher standard or something.
I thought kind of, I don't know, you've probably seen Barbie as well. But obviously one of the things that I noticed in Barbie was that there wouldn't be a film if it wasn't because the mother who starts kind of projecting her thoughts about death and horror onto Barbie, if she didn't have the dark side. And there is a kind of a moment where her daughter says to her about her drawings that she really loved them, and she feels like the darkness of those drawings is what she likes about the mother.
Yeah.
So I think kind of, if you want to take something positive, that's a nice thing about the Barbie film.
Thank you so much for this. Has been great. And is there anything else you want to say? Maybe like things that you're currently working on. What are you currently? You're mentioning this documentary project.
I'm working on a book about political violence in documentary films with a colleague in London. That book then does go across all continents and engages with the mostly post 2000 documentary films from Japan, from Europe, from the Middle East, etc. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
And also, like, is there a way to find you online or?
I'm not blogging or Twittering or anything. I'm obviously on email. So if anyone has a question they want to ask, they should feel free to send me an email. But it was great talking to you. So thank you so much for your interest in the book and for wanting to do this.
Yes, thank you for coming.
Yeah, it feels like now, obviously. Yeah, I've been speaking, but it would be fun to hear you speak a bit more. So what is it you're particularly interested in, or what are you working on at the moment?
I have this horror film festival, this women in horror film festival called Final Girls Berlin. I'm based in Berlin. Mm-hmm. We feature films, you can imagine, I guess.
I had a look at the site. It looks really impressive, and I've seen announcements before, so yeah, congratulations.
That's good to hear. And otherwise I also have, I'm a little freelance curator, so I have mm-hmm. I did create a series on female friendship films. Actually, Show Me Love would be one of the films I would show.
Isn't it a wonderful film?
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's really wonderful. I also showed We Are the Best, Lucas Moodysson's other. What else? I'm a translator. I subtitle. Just a little bit of this and that, but mostly like my passion, I guess, is this podcast here and the film festival.
And the festival, Well, that's already quite a lot.
If you ever come to Berlin, you can definitely come to the fest. I don't know.
It happens occasionally. And if you ever come to Oxford, you send me an email.
Okay, great. We'll do. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Have a nice evening.
Yeah, you too. And thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks to Chris Yoe Tokunaga for the music and Julie Saragoza for the sound mixing. You can follow Somebody's Watching on Instagram and Twitter, and you can also reach me anytime at somebodyswatchingpod@gmail.com. Please subscribe and rate Somebody's Watching on iTunes because it would really help with the podcast's visibility. Thanks!